Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, December 7th, 2025, and this is episode 23 of The Rift. Climate change is a social phenomenon. That's, of course, the animating principle of this radio show, after all, that our social and political lives shape the environment and it shapes us. Social constructions like race, class, and gender have all shaped the way that the planetary ecological crisis has manifested across the world. The expansion of European empires, the emergence of capitalism, and the racialization of colonized peoples were all critical in the formation of what we now understand to be the climate crisis. From which nations have become the biggest industrialized polluters to which populations are most victimized by the impacts of climate change. For more on that specifically, I'd recommend going back and listening to episode 14 of The Rift, which was my interview with Dr. Leon Seely Huggins about imperialism, racial capitalism, and the climate crisis. And you can find that episode and all previous episodes of the show on the podcast platform of your choosing. But one social construction which has been under-discussed in relation to the climate crisis is caste, and specifically India's caste system, a system of hereditary social classification that has been one of the primary vectors of discrimination and inequality in the subcontinent. De jure or de facto caste discrimination can limit the kind of jobs you can do, the housing you can live in, and even the people you can marry. But what role does it play in Indians' experience of the climate crisis? To find out, I spoke with Dr. Malini Ranganathan, professor at American University in Washington, D.C., and a political ecologist and geographer who has worked for years on caste and environmental politics. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about caste, labor, and the climate crisis, and how their intertwined history has shaped not just India, but the world. But first, programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store, specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode, now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com. And now, here's my conversation with Dr. Malini Ranganathan. I'm joined now by Malini Ranganathan, professor at the School of International Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Ranganathan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Roshan.
So just to start off, could you give a general overview of the work that you do and the thrust of your research?
I am a critical urban geographer interested in the political economy of land, labor, and the environment in cities under late capitalism. I have done research primarily in the city of Bangalore in southern India on questions of water access, which I also trace historically from the colonial period to the contemporary period in terms of the British Empire's focus on building water infrastructure, but the ways also in which particular groups, especially marginalized castes, the working classes, have been historically left out of state-provided infrastructure. And so that was really something that that got me interested in cities in South Asia during my doctoral work. Subsequent to that, I worked a lot on land politics in cities of the Global South, including in India. I have a book titled Corruption Plots, Stories, Ethics, and Publics of the Late Capitalist City, co-authored with Sapna Doshi and David Pike, which really gets at how ordinary urban residents are staging protests and activism around land grabbing and corrupt dealings in the real estate sector in cities. So I've always sort of come back to my core interest in really how power works in the urban environment. More recently, I've been thinking about the intersections between climate, migration, and labor politics in India, and doing field work connecting different geographies of the country and looking at the predicament of precarious Dalit and Muslim workers, particularly those employed in very informal situations in cities such as Bangalore and southern India, and you know what that means in the context of a far-right government in terms of their vulnerability, multiple forms of vulnerability. Because I'm a professor in the United States in Washington, D.C., I have also been drawn to the racial politics of housing and struggles for justice, environmental and social justice in America. And so I've written on climate justice and abolitionist politics in Washington, D.C., on Flint's lead poisoning crisis, and also on nitrate and other forms of poisoning in the Central Valley in California. So I guess the grand summary of this work is that I think of myself as an urban geographer and a scholar of environmental justice.
Right. And so much of what you were talking about, particularly in India, around the urban poor, around migrant laborers, oppressed castes, I would say most Americans and likely many listeners of this show, although I don't want to presume anything of my wonderful and erudite listener base, but a lot of people here are probably unfamiliar with the ways that caste politics manifest in India today. And I know that's a huge question, but could you talk a little bit about how these politics do manifest for the people that you're speaking about and the people that you're working with, you know, migrant laborers, yeah. Informally employed people, things like that in India?
There are certain, I think, very entrenched myths about India's caste system that I think are particularly prevalent in the West, right? A lot of people in the West think, oh, this is some very peculiar cultural religious tradition in India, right? And more than that, even people sort of just accept their place in the caste hierarchy. And the reason why these pernicious myths have endured is because I think that the project of caste supremacy and Brahmanism, which is the ideology that a very small minority, you know, of the people kind of dictate rules and how the system should be hierarchically ordered. The reason why it's these myths have been successful is because Brahmanistic ideology and caste supremacy have ended up you know, being quite hegemonic and almost normalizing the caste system, right? Of course, there is a long and valiant history of anti-caste politics and knowledge building and solidarity that has emerged over decades, most notably with the revolutionary work and even sort of legislative action of B.R. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, who was a civil rights leader and a Dalit himself, who really sort of led the struggle and turned some of what I just described as a kind of supremacist ideology on its head. But also through these anti-caste struggles, we've learned that it's not just a peculiar cultural facet, you know, of Hinduism, but that it transcends religion. And that it's very material and indelibly connected with class politics and class positions in society, right? And of course, there's a fluidity here. And depending on the particular political economic moment and the form of capitalism in India, caste is also malleable, and caste and class are malleable. So it's a system of social ordering that is cultural and ideological as much as it is material, right? In many of the similar ways that we can think of racial capitalism, as race being a kind of system of valuation through which capital accumulation proceeds, is very similar to the caste system. It's a system of human valuation through which capital accumulation can proceed. And so it has showed an uncanny ability to continue its presence and adaptability, whether we're talking about colonial and imperial capitalism, whether we're talking about nationalist capitalism, right, and state-led capitalism, whether we're talking about neoliberal capitalism, whether we're talking about, you know, what the scholar Anand Teltambe has called neoliberal Hindutva capitalism today, right, or a kind of confluence of right-wing ethno-nationalist ideology and a kind of corporate oligarchical power that is particularly extended through to particular allies, right, of the state. And so caste shows this ability to endure through these various formations of capitalism. And today what we're seeing, of course, is that caste is alive and well. It's alive and well in very visible ways, such as caste atrocities. You know, a Dalit man is lynched or violence is meted out if he dares transgress, right, the binaries of purity and pollution, if he dares transgress into spaces in which he's not allowed, if he dares to wear clothes that are supposedly clothes that only upper caste people are supposed to wear. So from the kind of very obvious ways in which caste atrocity and caste violence to much more subtle ways, let's say who gets recruited into jobs based on their last names, who gets rental accommodations, right, who is relegated to the outskirts of a city, because they're the working class, right? So those more from the overt to the subtle, caste is alive and kicking on the subcontinent. And it's certainly also an avenue through which politics is waged, right? Political battles, electoral battles, and forms of organizing are also waged. So that's the multidimensional story on caste today.
Right. And it seems like you've been paying attention, especially to the way that it's shaping people's responses to climate change in India and climate change induced disasters. You know, you've written on this a little bit in terms of migrant laborers being subjected to flooding and being especially susceptible to these environmental events that are being made more severe by the worsening of climate change. So could you talk a little bit more about how those caste politics are now intersecting with planetary ecological crisis?
I think that we know very well that those who are already in positions of vulnerability, labor disposability, who are already facing layer after layer of, you know, toxins in their environment are close to, let's say, highway pollution, those who are at agricultural laborers, you know, and are most susceptible to environmental challenges. Those are the groups, of course, that are, again, vulnerable to climate extremes, right? Whether it's extreme heat, whether it's flooding, whether it's, you know, other types of climate events. And so, of course, it is the laboring classes and the workers, especially those who are in outdoor jobs, let's say construction or agriculture or sanitation work, waste work, that are the lower and oppressed castes in India, right? This is a whole hierarchy between those who do so-called mental work, right, who are the priests and the lawyers and the knowledge producers, right, and then those who do manual work, and those are who are at the other end of the spectrum. who are the working classes. And, you know, this has been mapped out quite clearly for have a caste dimension, right? The whole labor market profile is very caste inflected. And so, again, the workers that are most precarious are Dalit, and they are the same workers that are also the most climate vulnerable. It's not just from an occupational standpoint. So, of course, someone who's working out in the sun all day is going to be most affected by extreme heat days, especially if there are no breaks given, or there's no day offs, or there's no shade, right? Or there's no bathroom, not sufficient hydration, right? But it's also where they live, because there are these overlapping spheres of precarity where it's both labor and housing. And so where they live might be in flood-prone areas. It might be areas that obviously don't have proper ventilation, that are built out of materials that might overheat. And so it's a layer after layer that crosses from occupational safety to also the safety of their settlements. And so in my work, I've looked very much at migrant laborers who are in flood-prone, informal settlements, slums, both declared and undeclared, officially slums, and also unofficially slums, and much more like rudimentary slums. These are the areas that get flooded. They don't have proper drainage infrastructure, which is another layer, right, of what they're deprived of. So it's what Alpasha and Jens Lersch have called conjugated oppression. It's these intersecting ways in which discrimination kind of plays out, along the lines of caste, class, gender, ethnicity, religion. So certainly migrant workers, I think, today in India are amongst the most climate vulnerable in the country, and actually everywhere around the world.
And, you know, I understand that in your kind of currently ongoing work, you're beginning to argue that to understand these politics, particularly in the context of climate change and caste and interlocked oppressions, we need to understand the historical patterns of resource extraction and colonization in India. And certainly that's, I would say, been a pattern across scholarship in the West. But, pertaining specifically to India, could you elaborate on your work in that area?
Yeah. It was a kind of a chance encounter for me. In my most recent work that I've been doing, I was looking at the history of a slum in Bangalore. And I had found a report from the 1950s by on this particular slum and the life stories of the residents of the slum that had actually left parts of the Madras Presidency, right, under the British regime. Madras Presidency were areas that were often drought prone, famine prone, and especially North Arcot and South Arcot, which were two districts of the Madras Presidency, you had a lot of out-migration of Dalits coming into industrializing centers, right? Of course, textile industry, but other industries were also there in Bangalore, so they were working in these industries. But that same archival report from the 1950s talked about migrant laborers who were known as coolies from the Tamil the word for daily wage, were going to the rubber plantations of Malaya. They were going to these far outposts of the British Empire. And of course, we know that from northern India, particularly Bihar and Bodh Gaya districts, coolies went to the Caribbean. And so there's a long history of Dalit castes and landless migrants going for indentured servitude and then coolie work, right, when indentured servitude was officially abolished by the British Empire, but there was essential forms of contract labor. And so those conditions of exploitation where they were contract labor, they were working in very extractive, jobs in terms of rubber plantations and other kinds of plantations, of course, sugar in the Caribbean, got me interested in what's the longer history of precarious labor under conditions of climate extremes. So they were leaving drought-prone districts. The British literally called them famine districts of the Madras Presidency. And these, they were known as Kanganis, who literally means overseers. In northern India, they were Sirdars. They were these contractors from kind of the middle castes, the landowning castes, who'd go to these famine and drought-prone districts and recruit coolies. And then they would be shipped off literally in massive coolie ships to work on these imperial extractive plantations. And so for me, you know, the whole system of indentured servitude, the whole system of contract labor actually has never left us. And today's too, under neoliberalization, the public sector has been hollowed out, and we see more and more the use of middle-caste, landed-caste contractors who are going to climate-distressed areas, agrarian distressed areas, where there's debt, where workers are facing, you know, especially SCST or scheduled caste, scheduled tribe workers are facing debt, and recruiting them to construction sites in Bangalore, right? In fact, there is a really strange, not strange, but I suppose one can contextualize it in within contemporary sort of extractive capitalism in the Middle East. A lot of workers go and work on construction sites in Dubai. They're also working in construction in Israel. And some of these workers are treated quite badly, quite disposable ways. So there is a new indenture. Some of my union friends in India refer to it as the new indenture, right? Because these contractual conditions essentially are forms of neo-bondage. And in my work, being a critical geographer who thinks about you know, relations of caste and oppression and labor across time periods, it was helpful for me to understand this contract labor system back in the day, you know, starting from 120 years ago. I mean, the coolie system was very prevalent even in the early 19th centuries, especially the first coolies arrived in Mauritius and Fiji. But in my work, I've been looking at archives of the Tamil Dalits who then also went not only to Bangalore, but also went to the plantations of Malaya and Penang.
My next question was going to be about kind of connecting this all to broader ideas around racial capitalism, right? And it seems like the connection might be more direct than I might have thought, but you know, there is this body of scholarship connecting the emergence of racial capitalism in the West with the planetary ecological crisis, right? Specifically that the Industrial Revolution in Europe, European colonization, and the transatlantic slave trade were all kind of mutually co-constitutive, so to speak, and that the resulting boom in colonial resource extraction and appropriation ultimately laid the foundation for today's so-called Anthropocene, right? The era of climate change. And, you know, thinking about how some of these Dalit workers were going off and working already in the Caribbean plantations around that time, where do you think this kind of fits into that broader narrative about capitalism and the climate crisis?
Yeah, thank you. You've described that literature so nicely, in the sense of, you know, we cannot think about the industrial boom and the industrial revolution accumulation of capital in the West, in Europe and America, without understanding histories of slavery, you know, in the Caribbean and America, in the Americas. And so the kind of larger history of slavery and capitalism is so important in thinking through that relationship between wealth production in the West, and of course thinking about Walter Rodney's classic work on how Europe underdeveloped Africa, and sort of, you know, the structural underdevelopment, right, of parts of Africa in order to produce that wealth. I think, and then in turn, how that also has fueled the climate crisis, because those were extraordinarily fossil intensive forms of production, right? And even the plantation with its cropping and use of extreme chemicals, and the kind of dehumanization of labor and the destruction of nature went hand in hand. And so we think about the plantational scene as also a way to understand the racial aspects of the Anthropocene. So I think that literature is very helpful in doing that. But I think the story that's missing from that literature is precisely caste, right? Because we think about the African enslaved as the sort of agent of history, or the subject that through which wealth was derived. Of course, there was genocide of Native people that went hand in hand with that in the Americas. But what's missing from that is the Dalit labor that went into producing global capitalism, right? And so for me, I tell a small piece of that story. Think about the commodity of rubber. At precisely the moment 1910 to 1940 was the big global rubber boom, of which Malaya, what is today known as Malaysia, and of course, you know, Singapore was part of a larger, the Federation of Malay States. That region of the world was the largest producer of rubber. Brazil had gone down in rubber production, even though originally the rubber plant and its development was kind of grown first in Brazil, and British botanists basically discovered how to grow it elsewhere as well. And so Amazonian production went down, and it started growing in Southeast Asia at precisely the time that the automobile became mass-produced in the United States. Right. And we know that, of course, the automobile and its guzzling of gasoline, is one of the prime drivers of higher carbon emissions in the atmosphere. So, you know, we talk a lot in the contemporary climate discourse about how the global south, you know, shoulders a disproportionate impact of climate change, whereas the global north is responsible for climate change. And yes, that's true. But we forget the workers that were involved, right, in producing those commodity frontiers for global capitalism. And so therefore, it's not just that they're a kind of passive, victimized set of people, but they were really important actors in the whole story of global capitalism and the whole story of climate change. But they themselves were dispossessed of their labor in this production. And so for me, it's kind of like retelling the story of global capitalism through the angle of labor and through the angle of caste. And caste was indispensable. Caste hierarchy and caste supremacy was indispensable in the advancement of fossil capitalism, what you can think of as essentially fossil capitalism, right? It's the rubber, it's the cars, it's the burning of petroleum. So I think that's a kind of a it's sort of an off the map. Like if you think of a map of the world and the spotlight has been like, you know, America, Caribbean, and of course the transatlantic slave trade. What about Southeast Asia? What about the Madras Presidency? What about the plantations of Malaya? It's another way of telling the global racial capitalism story through an explicit focus on caste and labor and indenture.
Right, and we've of course talked a lot about racial capitalism and the formation of capitalism around this time, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'm curious how you think about the Indian caste system alongside racialization, or whether it's a form of racialization, whether you see it as something kind of distinct. Where do you kind of place it in the broader framework of racial capitalism?
Yeah, this is a really important question that often gets very emotional responses because especially on the subcontinent, and even with Babasaheb Ambedkar's own work, you know, caste and race are extremely different, right? Caste is a extreme form of social construction. It's birth ordained, but it has nothing to do with phenotype. It has nothing to do with skin color. It has nothing to do with your hair type, right? Whereas race is physical, and people can tell the difference between one race or the other, and caste you cannot. Now, this binary and the difference between caste and race actually misreads race in the sense that race is not just visual and a phenotypical. It also neglects the fact that from a long time, essentially since the Portuguese arrived, you know, in the 1500s, followed by the way in which British Orientalists understood caste, it was through refracting caste through understandings of race. So in some senses, caste in the production of the knowledge about it has always been racialized, right? You think about social scientists that really essentially understood the Brahmin as having purer, quote unquote, blood to the Aryan, right? And the Dalit as having less pure blood and being basically the indigenous people of the region and that were invaded by the Aryans. And there's a whole kind of story around the Brahmin essentially being closer to the European race and the Dalits being closer to some sort of indigenous and subjugated race. And that Indo-Aryan invasion theory was actually is espoused as much by the British as it was by upper caste people within the subcontinent, right? And so there are these racial theories, whether we like it or not, honestly, and that animated how caste was understood. And so in some senses, it's like they're joined at the hip, right? And Jesus Jairez Garza has done really good work on how even untouchability had these really racial overtones to them, right? I mean, even if you think about segregation, untouchability, pollution, it's got this real like racial understanding of purity, blood purity even. And so in some senses, there's a kind of epistemology of caste that has always in some ways been read through race. Now, for my purposes, the reason why to bring them together is also the global solidarity movement in terms of the Dalit Panthers taking their name directly from the Black Panthers, in terms of understanding their predicament, that is to say Dalits, especially Maharashtrian Dalits, understanding their predicament as in many ways similar to African Americans in the United States, and seeking to therefore put caste on the radar through the Durban Conference of 2002 as a form of birth-based discrimination that I think the Indian government has strategically tried to underplay and say, oh, it's just ritual, it's just religious, it's kind of unique to Hinduism, it's not really a form of discrimination across the region. And so there's both epistemological and strategic from political standpoint view to bring them together. From an academic standpoint, if you take a critical race theory understanding of racialization, not race per se, but racialization, which is essentially, you know, the process by which certain qualities are ascribed as indelibly natural or innate to particular people, right? And these shift over time, then I think caste does, the caste discrimination does engage in this process of racialization. You know, for instance, the Dalits are understood as being hardier and being able to work outside, right? And even the ways in which Brahmins think of themselves as like much more delicate, right? That's a form of self-racialization. And also ascribing certain qualities like cleanliness, right, to non-meat eaters, to vegetarians, whereas dirtiness is ascribed to meat eaters, right? That is a form of racialization because you're kind of imbuing particular traits and habits with this kind of primordial essence or essentialization. And certain people are that way because they eat meat. So I think there is a racialization that goes on. There's also a kind of attachment of criminality, let's say, right, to particular groups. And this you see especially happening with the racialization of the Muslim. And I think you cannot understand the racialization of the Muslim without understanding the ways in which caste is operational. Because in fact, notions of Brahmanism that I mentioned earlier, right? This notion of the kind of superiority of particular groups and the kind of dharmic or ordained set of rules that society has subscribed to, works to then subjugate the Muslim and to kind of think of the Muslim as an outsider, racialize the Muslim as an external, impure presence in the polity. So we cannot understand, I think, racialization and literally plain old garden variety racism against Blacks in India without seeing these interconnected, you know, ideological and material systems with very interesting and important histories.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned indigeneity, and earlier you also mentioned the colonization of the Americas and the genocide of indigenous people here. And you know, when I was reading the piece that you co-authored in 14 Magazine, you know, you open it with this quote from the journalist Jaya Rani, and it reads, quote, "Dalits are not afraid of climate change or any other natural disasters because socially and economically they've been leading a disastrous life forever. For them, disaster caused by the upper caste Hindus is the real problem," end quote. And reading that, I immediately thought of the work of Potawatomi scholar Kyle White over at the University of Michigan, who has argued quite forcefully that dystopian narratives around climate change and treating climate change as this unprecedented dystopic event loses sight of the fact that the present day for indigenous peoples in the Americas is a dystopia. It's a reality where a genocide has already taken place, where ecosystems have been destroyed, the result of several centuries of settler colonialism. And, you know, you were talking about global solidarity and building connections between these movements. How do you understand the relationship between some of that work on indigeneity here and, you know, Dalit political thought in India?
So that is also exactly who I thought of, Kyle White, when I read that quote, which is why I liked it so much, because I've taught and read, you know, his work on climate and the indigenous experience in a much longer history, right, of genocide and destruction and settler colonial appropriation of land. And why I like that quote is because it decenters climate as the be-all, end-all of disaster. And it really literally locates climate and climate extremes and climate precipitators within hierarchical social systems and economic extraction and conditions of exploitation, right? So it's a great quote to think about the ways in which climate intersects with all these other things going on in people's lives, particularly caste oppression. I would say the solidarity movement is advancing because of youth activists who are seeing connections between the indigenous experience, let's say in the Americas, and indigenous peoples all around the world, including within India. And this is where I think the thought leadership really is coming from. Because for youth, I think there's no other choice but to build that transnational understanding and that transnational sense of commonality, right? I think especially, let's say, with the experience of mining that you're seeing indigenous groups now at the forefront of in South America. And then central India is being pillaged in terms of coal mining and other kinds of mining, and indigenous groups being basically completely dispossessed of their land. And what's worse, there's violence, outright state violence being exerted against indigenous groups. And so, you know, whether it's the confluence of their lands being stolen, their resources being stolen, you know, their state justifying the violence against them. So to me, it's the sort of youth activists that are making those connections. I haven't seen the connections being made in academia per se, but academia always is a couple of steps behind what is actually the pulse of activism. And it's not just this kind of international activism, which I think is great, but really on the ground activism, which I think if there was to be opportunities for Native American indigenous activists to meet with, you know, let's say in Brazil or, you know, in Peru, to meet with Adivasi groups in central India, right? That experience of extractive capitalism and oligarchical capitalism, honestly, that is dispossessing them, I think would be really commonly felt. And so, you know, one would just hope that in the years to come, there's going to be much more learning, I think, to come across these regions, rather than seeing them as like irreducibly different.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue into my last real question for you. And I know that we're kind of coming up against a time limit for you, but I'm just to kind of close out, I'm wondering where you hope to see activism and research around, you know, race and climate change and global solidarity move in the short term and long term future.
Yeah, I always like to end on the kind of note of hope, but also provocative note that I think the only way we will build a successful liberatory climate movement is if it's not about climate per se, right? I mean, it's climate beyond climate. It's climate. It's radical climate politics beyond climate. And what I mean by that is the only way such a movement would be successful is if it gets the working classes who might be concerned about kidney disease because of extreme heat to join a movement, or the movement for dignified wages for sanitation workers, right? To be part of the conversation or the movement around housing and dispossession by real estate interests, but also by flooding, would be part of the climate conversation. So it's like, how do we move it forward in a way that is also discursively inclusive of what people are actually experiencing in their lives? This is something I've struggled with. I do think that there's a disconnect between the ways in which academics like me or you would talk about climate and climate policy, climate justice, and what people are actually, their lived realities of the everyday sort of disaster of oppression that they're facing on the ground, that is both climate and beyond that, right? And so that movement for climate beyond climate is something I've been thinking through intellectually. I'm trying to write about it in my Climate of Labor Justice book. It's called The Climate of Labor Justice: Planetary Ecologies of Race, Caste, and Capitalism. And bringing to light some of these on the ground intersectional movements too, that are doing probably far more for environmental justice than any movement that officially has the name, or any organization or NGO that officially has the name environment in it, you know?
Yeah, this is, I don't know if you realize how many conversations I've had over the past couple of years that this echoes.
That's great. No, we have to talk more. So I'm thinking through it through, you know, the case of my own field work. And I was really inspired a couple of years ago and really heartened. I was giving a talk in Bangalore's Cubbon Park, and Fridays for Future had invited me. It's a youth organization. Disha Ravi was part of the invitation of people who invited me. She's a climate activist, very well known in Delhi, but lives in Bangalore. And she and her comrades in FFF invited me. So I had talked about flood risk in Bangalore and caste and the history of climate risk there. But at the same time that we were there, I was giving this talk in Cubbon Park on a Sunday morning. Members from a kind of left labor union also joined the conversation, as did protesters who were protesting the demolition of Afreen Fatima's house, who's a Muslim student who was very much part of the Shaheen Bagh protests, and her father was a Muslim leader. And they were protesting sort of the bulldozer Raj and the criminalization of Muslim homes. And so it became this really nice conversation across like an anti-fascist, anti-hate group, like a couple of youth communist left activists who were also doing some work on labor, migrant labor, and then the Fridays for Future group was typically middle-class, educated Indians talking about climate. And it was such a great way that organically brought together these different constituents around my talk, but then they kind of stayed in touch. And now Fridays for Future joins some of the left organizing as well, and vice versa. So, I mean, that was a nice moment for me. It's like a kind of a highlight for me that I hope happens more.
Yeah, well, don't we all? But that's as good a place as any to wrap things up, I think. But just before you go, where can people continue to follow your work?
Yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity, Roshan. It's always nice to speak with someone so like-minded and who's right there with you in terms of climate and labor and progressive politics. I'm reachable. I'm on social media, especially say Instagram at Malini Ranga, probably more than X or any other platform. I'm on Blue Sky off and on, but at Malini Ranga. But the best way is probably email malini@american.edu. And so I'd be happy to connect, especially with people who are interested in continuing scholar activism in this vein.
Great. Well, Dr. Malini Ranganathan, professor at the American University School of International Studies, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Roshan.
That was my conversation with Dr. Malini Ranganathan. I'd like to thank her once again for sharing her expertise and her important research with all of us. I think it's often forgotten that as we see far-right governments on the rise, of course here in the United States, in Europe, in Israel, that there's a far-right government that has been in power in India for more than a decade, and that grievance along religious and caste-based lines is one of the primary ways that it has consolidated its power. It's so important to be able to understand how these social constructions like caste have come to be, and how, throughout history, they have shaped and continue to shape the world we live in now. As Dr. Ranganathan said, this kind of learning is essential in order to build a global solidarity movement that can undo these harms. And so I'm very appreciative of the work that she's doing and her part in helping us learn. And with that, that is today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, we have some tunes up until the top of the hour, and then it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, December 21st. Until then, take care.
Texas, I can tell by the way he's two-stepping round the room, and judging by the smile that's written on his face, there's nothing I can do. No, it doesn't take a crystal ball to see a cowboy always fight. can tell. Come on, baby. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, along with our community partners, including Bash Pepper Roofing, Champaign Park District, Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, and Live Action Games. Listener-supported, volunteer-run since 1981. Community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM WEFT.
90.1 FM, your community radio station since 1981.
And go. Woo!
While window shopping through the past, I ran across a looking glass, reflecting moments remaining in a burned out life. Tragic magic, prayers of passion, stay the same through changing fashion, to freeze my mind like water on a winter's night. Spend most of my youth out hobo cruising, and all I got for proof is rocks in my pockets and dirt in my shoes. A goodbye, non-believer. Don't you know that I hate to leave here? So long, babe, I got the flashback blues. Photographs show the laughs, recorded in between the bad times, happy sailors dancing on a sinking ship.